This week on the show, when to go steady, when to walk away, and how to make money from your hobby. All this on This Week in Media, episode 110. Hey there, boys and girls. We are back with another edition, an all-studio edition of This Week in Media. And we have some fresh meat this time and some returning meat.
Ooh, Nelly.
As always, Alex Lindsay is here in the studio with me. Thank you, hello. Alex.
Thank you.
Well, actually, today, we're recording this a little bit early. It'll be distributed whatever week you're listening to this. Maybe even 2 years into the future if you are needing to catch up on episodes of This Week in Media. But we're recording it because there's a conference in town today in San Francisco at iHollywood Web Video Marketing Summit. So I've got a lot of great, some of my favorite sources, web producers, sort of executives. Anyway, I'll just go around and let you know who's here. Tim Street, returning.
Hello,
here a couple weeks ago. Thank you for coming back.
Hey, thanks for having me back. I thought you guys would kick me off or something.
We love having Tim here.
You entertained us. Yeah, Alex and I gossiped about you afterwards. Hey, what do you think about Tim? Bring him back. For the first time, we have Clay Nichols. Clay is the executive producer and host of Dad Labs. That's a web show about, you know, tips for dads, distributed by For Your Imagination. Clay, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Davey. It's great. Daisy,
whatever. You know, I mess up guest names all the time. Like last week, I called Brent half of the time. So really, it's okay. A lot of people call me Lucy. That's my dog's name. So hey, whatever works.
Well, it's great to be here, and I'll call you Daisy most of the time. How about that?
That's fair enough. Good. And now we also have Tim Shea. He's one of the co-founders of Next New Networks. Now Tim is one of the few suits that I would allow on the show. That's a compliment. Now, Tim's an executive at Next New, and actually, if you could see him dressed today, he looks the part of an executive, but most of the time, Tim is sort of like the rest of us. He's kind of like wearing his t-shirt, his Converse sneakers, and he has a long and storied background as a content producer, so that's why we let him come play. Thank you for joining us, Tim.
Well, thanks.
So that way we get started. It's an interesting piece in New TV recently about what constitutes a hit online these days, and I think that's been evolving as, you know, we've all been participating in various ways in this medium. So one of the things the story said was that if you looked at it, say, a year ago, New TV did the same story a year ago, and at that time, Rever said that 100,000 views in a day was a hit for Rever. Jib Jab said 1.5 million plays in the first week was a hit for them. Funny or Die says 100,000 views doesn't cut it anymore. Now you need a million or more for a hit. Tim, you've got Next New Networks is, for those of you who don't know, is a web video production, distribution, network. I mean, that's why you have network in your name. But one of your most popular shows, videos, is Obama Girl. And that's gotten a lot of hits. Okay, so take something like that, take other shows. How do you measure what is a hit?
Right. Well, you know, part of it is it's not really a hits-driven medium. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, while we all see a lot of viral videos that get, you know, tons and tons of views, building a business is about getting an audience to come back on a regular basis. And it's something that, you know, all these guys here on the panel, they've all done is they have people to come back every time. When you're actually trying to get an advertiser or a sponsor to come into content, it's a hard enough sell when you're selling something like web video, which they may have never seen or they may not be paying a lot of attention to. When you can speak to the fact that you can deliver an audience regularly, that's what's going to matter. So, you know, for us, a hit is something where the audience is really engaged and they're coming back and they're growing every week. And it's of a size that is meaningful to an advertiser. Dad Labs is a great example because they've got a meaningful audience for the sponsors that bring them in. We've got a show that's probably a similar size called Threadbanger that's one of our, you know, one of our best moneymakers in the company. And it is pure, authentic. You know, it's really, really dedicated to what the audience cares about. And, you know, maybe it does about a million views a month, but, you know, that's a big hit for us in that
category.
And
how many episodes a week do you release? Is it one a week?
You know, that's another thing. They have a regular show that's about once a week, but one of the things they've learned from, you know, one thing that's interesting about having Threadbanger and Barely Political under one roof is that they start to influence each other. So Barely Political does a lot of topical stuff. That's where the home of the Obama Girl videos. And they'll have regular things, but then they'll also very opportunistically put things out. And we've even had that start to happen on Threadbanger, where Threadbanger has a regular weekly show every Friday. but they're now doing regular video blogs. Whenever something's on their mind, they get out there, and it's definitely driven a lot more. You know, the audience loves having a regular thing to tune into, but they also just love any more content they can get from the host. They love it every time the host put up a video, so that drives a lot too.
So you don't feel that, like, oh, I want to get a million views for this.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. You know, I think that, but, you know, we give all our stuff time to grow and time to find an audience. And Barely Political is obviously a huge hit. You know, it had something like 15 million views just last month. But you know,
I want to get Ben on this show.
I think Ben would love to be on the show.
All right. I enjoyed talking to him. I did an interview with him a couple of weeks ago. Really, really smart guy. Love talking to him. So we need to get him on This Week in Media.
He's way more interesting than me, yeah.
But for those of you that don't know, Ben is the creator of Obama Girl.
Yeah, I know. I'm too insidery right now. Ben, how do you pronounce this? It's because I can't pronounce his last name.
Ben Rellis. And, you know, so Barely Political and, you know, they'd made two Obama Girl videos when they joined Next New Networks. And it wasn't so much Obama Girl that made us want to bring Barely Political in. It was sitting down and talking to Ben. You know, this guy just has an amazing point of view, and he just walked in and kind of blew our minds. You know, he talked about how he did this great thing where he said, you know, if you look at all the top videos on YouTube, they're about either a comedy, they're a music video, or they're about politics, or they're sexy. So I just mixed all four, you know, and it was so like, the fact that he had a plan and he executed on it, but he did it in such a totally original and creative way. He just was, you know, we're like, we have to get this guy on the team. And he's been a huge influence on the company.
And one of the things that we talked about for the story we did recently, which I think is still applicable and maybe even more so, because certainly is what we're seeing with the election, is just this rabid consumption of, you know, viral videos. I mean, just recently, of course, it's, you know, everyone is gobbling up either the Katie Couric pieces of interviews with Sarah Palin or the Tina Fey spoofs of that. And what Ben had said when I talked to him on the phone, and this kind of sounds obvious when you say it, but I think a lot of brilliant comments are ones where you're like, oh yeah, that is right. But he talked about how what viral video is when it comes to politics is not necessarily that different from when, you know, we were in sixth grade or seventh grade and watching Saturday Night Live for the first time and being exposed to the, you know, the parody or whoever was doing George Bush then or whatever it was. And, you know, those kind of things, they really like can stick in your brain and you remember them. And now it's morphed into parodies that we find online. Clay, what sort of views are you getting at Dad Labs, and how do you measure what constitutes a hit? And do you even think about it as a hit or as just a steady show?
Well, I sort of like hearing Tim say that you know, sort of not in the hit business. I mean, if we are, we're in trouble because we've never had one. You know, we're sort of in an interesting position sort of between being a pure entertainment show and also sort of being a resource, because our videos are often topical on something that a dad, you know, wants to get information on, you know, what to do when his kid poops in the tub or does something unspeakable. So, you know, we're sort of in between there. So we're not really always looking for huge numbers. You know, a hit for us is often determined by the sort of response that our advertisers give us. I mean, you know, obviously we're trying to please the audience first and foremost, but a lot of times our advertisers are most likely to come on board again if they just love the content. I mean, I haven't seen a correlation between the statistics and advertisers re-upping with us. That's sort of the crazy thing. Like, if they love the show and they feel like it's doing something great for their brand.
How do they measure it, though? I mean, is there a way to measure? I mean, I know that there are a lot of companies like Visible Measures and whatnot that are, you know, really getting into measuring engagement with online video and measuring that by how much time people spend watching the video, at what point you tune out of the video, whether you fast forward it, things like that, which I think are important. I think we need in this business. But, I mean, do you measure it by the comments that you get or the number of emails that you get or the feedback?
All that goes into judging whether a show has been successful or not. You know, the number of comments, the amount of engagement, the excitement, the number of different blogs write about it, the number of views. I mean, all those are obviously important in how we evaluate it. But ultimately, right now, where web video is for us, it's about brand development. I mean, from the advertiser perspective anyway. So a lot of that is a very gut kind of business. You know, it's them saying, wow, we really love having your show affiliated with our brand.
I mean, a lot of people who ask us to distribute, you know, they want to distribute stuff or they want to work with us or they want to do shows are fans of MacBreak. You know, like they like watching MacBreak or whatever, and it usually starts off of the people who want to work with us. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot that don't like MacBreak, and they don't want to work with us at all. You know, and so, but we noticed that's for us one of the big things is that we just get, I really like what you're doing with MacBreak. We'd like to talk to you about X, Y, and Z. From that point of view, and both stuff that we've done for hire and working with other shows and everything else is connected to that. And I have to admit, we don't really measure much of anything. I mean, we.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
Yes.
We have no idea how many listeners we have,
we
can make it up. Well, they just don't tell me.
Yeah, exactly.
Alex doesn't want to depress me anymore. He's like, well, since you started hosting, Daisy, we've lost about 80% of our listeners.
I didn't want to admit that we have twice as many listeners as we did before, so somehow the old host was not worth it. So anyway, I do think that, for us, the big thing is, I have to admit, and we're in a slightly different situation where our day-to-day isn't really being paid for by the shows that we do. I mean, they make money, or they make some money, but we do them they're all R&D for us. So right. To us, every show requires a different pipeline, requires different kinds of processes, requires different, let's do one where the walls are flying around. That's the next one that we're doing. So the walls are going to be flying around and doing all kinds of crazy
probably
stuff.
Probably not for the new Media Minute, though.
No. But the white works well.
It does.
But I do think that obviously what we find, though, is after, I think Woody Allen once said, 90% of it is just showing up. And if we can just keep on doing the show, we build this audience, we build a listenership, we build a committed number of people that will react. I mean, I know that people are watching MacBreak mostly, and I know that it's making some impact, mostly because I feel like a pinata when I'm at WWDC or Macworld, where you get all these people who really enjoy watching the show. And one person walking up to me at Macworld, I shouldn't say this, it's going to get me in trouble, but one person walking up to me is like 100 people that I can see on a number. One person walking up and saying...
You can't take that to an advertiser, though. I mean, standards are on the way. You look at companies like TubeMogul and Visible Measures. I mean, eventually we're going to have standards as to what's a view. Is a view
right.
Is a view or a listen? Is it halfway through? Is it all the way through? I mean, there's going to be some kind of standard that'll be developed.
I know most of our advertisers are paying attention to reaction. So, like, for instance, Audible is paying us
it's a cost per acquisition.
They're doing CPM.
Okay.
But what they're measuring is whether we, if a lot of people don't go up to audible.com/twim, for instance, they won't do it again. So I think a lot of guys, a lot of our advertisers, they do have specific things they're measuring. And one of the things that we have to figure out is what are they measuring? They'll pay us on CPM or they'll pay us on whatever it is, but there is something that's important to them. And that can be different for every advertiser. For Audible, it's they want people to go up and download a free book. For for a different company, it might be they want people to just go to the website and they want to measure it somehow. And for some of our advertisers, it is because they listen to it and they know that people like me listen to it and I want to be, connected to that.
One of the tough things, we often work with sponsors that are completely outside the tech business. I mean, it's, if you got a guy that sells baby bottles, he's in the rubber nipple business. He doesn't necessarily understand a lot of the metrics by which, success on the web is measured. So a lot of times,
so you can just hoodwink them, Clay, right?
That's how I'm here. Actually, that's what
I think a real opportunity of this medium is the fact that we can bring in advertisers that, might not be advertising in national media. One of our biggest advertisers right now is a company called Janome that makes sewing machines. And, they really see the audience that watches this show, Threadbanger, as the future of their business. Their customer base is aging. They mainly advertise in places like print, trade magazines and trade shows for sewing. They look at something like Threadbanger and they go, well, this is a movement. There's all these young kids sewing and we want to be there. And just this, they've advertised with us for about 6 months, and the extent of conversation with the community that they have now that they didn't have prior to getting involved with Threadbanger, they ride along with the show in a lot of different ways. It allows us to be really authentic, really credible. It's very clear where the sponsor comes in and what the sponsor, people saw a real difference in the show when the sponsor came in. These extra segments we were able to do, these high-end sewing machines we were able to give away to the audience, and the travel we were able to do. that, you know, they really saw the impact and how having a sponsor made their favorite show better. And one of the most interesting evolutions that happened for us, and I could see something like this happening if it hasn't already with Dad Labs, is that we actually entered into a licensing relationship with Janome. We now have Threadbanger branded Janome sewing machines that debuted last month. They're entry level computerized sewing machines, and we've already sold like a ton of them. You know,
a ton. Can you be more specific?
I don't know if I can say
literally a ton. Yep. Right. They measure it by weight.
Well, you know, it's the funny thing is they shipped over 20,000 of these things on a they shipped them over from Japan, and you know, we were getting the photos of the pallets coming over on the ship and hoping it didn't get hijacked by Somali pirates, but they're in stores all over the country now. People, when they see those, there's brochures that go along with them that tell people about Threadbanger, so people, it's actually exposing us to a broader audience.
Now, Threadbanger, just very briefly, is a show about do-it-yourself fashion.
It's do-it-yourself fashion. It's for people who make their own fashion, everybody from aspiring fashion designers to people who like remix thrift store clothes. And, we now are getting emails from people going, you know, I started watching the show because I bought this cool sewing machine. And that's amazing. And, you know, the other thing that's amazing is that, you know, we didn't have a line item in our, you know, in our, you know, P&L sheets or whatever. This is the soup part of me talking. You know, we didn't have a, we weren't planning on any revenue coming from this. And now it's becoming a significant thing, as significant as the advertising on the show.
Well, that's
so
really
that's like a great sign for everybody, because we just really started that network to kind of get out there and see what you could do in that space.
That's a good investment for the sponsor as well. I mean, this is a great opportunity for them to invest in their new market and to see what they can do.
I think that the other thing is how many other places can someone releasing a sewing machine, you know, advertise into effectively? I mean, they're not going to put it on ABC, you know, before the news. They're not going to put it on Monday Night Football or something like that. They need somewhere they can get that. And I think that this is what our industry provides for, is this kind of pinpoint accuracy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to be able to say that there's less waste, you know, for Clay to be able to go into, or Tim to be able to go in and say, if you really want to reach your audience, I've got them, you know, and I know exactly who they are, and, you know, you're going to, you know, you might reach 500,000 people instead of 5 million people, but if it's the right 500,000, I mean, we probably all say things like that when we're talking to advertisers.
And it goes back to the original question about, like, what makes a hit? I mean, in some sense, the brilliance of that deal, of that Threadbanger deal, which was inspiring to us, and I think it's such a cool deal, because it says you can find something that's different than a sort of standard sort of television dimension of a deal, and it really works. It works for the advertiser. It works for the show. And that allows us to do, I think, kind of changes the conversation a little bit, because instead of people thinking about a television kind of deal, they think about a web TV kind of deal. And this is obviously where our chips are, picking a niche, you know, bringing that audience together, and then going to a very specific advertiser who wants that targeted approach, rather than someone that's trying to someone that's getting the million views per show that's a hit. You know, maybe that's not, you know, that to me competes with a traditional media.
Well, Tim, you do a little of both, right? I mean, because you get huge views, but you have sponsors integrated, right?
Yeah, I promise our sponsors 150,000 views. I deliver between 1 million and 5 million, but it doesn't happen all at once. I mean, it takes a little while. We have a long tail, and it's not topical in terms of a timely way. I mean, these are evergreen as we can make them, so that when people go search for, you know, how to share private videos 6 months from now, they're going to find the sponsored episode from MDialog.
Talk about how that deal came together. I've spoken to Greg at MDialog about that, but how did that come together for our listeners?
Sure. You know, there's different ways that deals come together for French Made TV, but it's usually, you know, talking with the sponsor and finding out what are your goals? What do you want your audience to take away from this episode? What's the one thing that you do different than your competitors? And how can we make that the focus of the episode? How can we title that? What are the search words that they're going to be searching for to find you? And how can we make that the title of the episode? And so in talking with MDialog, we came up, you know, we talked about the different things that they do, the hosting that they provide, the fact that they're on the iPhone. But they had a way of sharing private video that they really felt was valuable to people who maybe they just want, you know, they've got some baby videos that they want to show to grandma and nobody else. Or, you know, maybe they've got some personal private videos.
Some sexy videos, you mean.
there you go, that they want to share with no one else or just a few people. And so that's what the episode is about.
Group private videos.
Yeah.
I have a question about how to do this in a way that feels authentic, but we should probably thank our sponsors, Alex.
So we'd like to thank our sponsor for this show is Object Matrix. And so Object Matrix is a bulletproof, basically, backup system. So it's something that we've been testing or we have tested here in the office with some success. And so what it basically does is this is like if you want bank level, I'm never going to lose my data kind of a backup. Object Matrix makes a system that basically allows you to put it in the background. You can put it actually runs a Final Cut Pro server. On the front end, it's a little geeky, but basically you can have a Final Cut Pro server there and know that it's basically mirroring it over three drives, three RAIDs. So if there's always two copies, if one RAID goes down, it makes another copy on one of the other RAIDs. So there's always two copies of everything that you have. And one of the big things that we have here in the office is that nothing exists until it exists in two places. So if you are looking for that kind of, if you're doing, especially if you're doing stuff like archives, you know, we've gotten some questions for smaller stuff, for stuff that we're doing. I mean, we've talked about Drobo in the past, and for an individual, this is not an individual's kind of solution. But if for an individual that just wants their music backed up, Drobo is something that we use a lot of. But if you're talking about really having stuff that's important to your business, you know, something like Object Matrix makes a lot more sense as you start to go through that. One of the things to know is if you want to test it, if you've got RAIDs or if you've got Mac Minis and Drobos, or because the both of them can work together, because this is really just a system, a file system that allows you to do that. You know, the first 15 terabytes are free. So you can manage it with the software. You can stack a bunch of Mac Minis on top of a couple Drobos and then turn the system on and make it all work. And you have a great system to make sure that everything stays you know, in existence, which is oftentimes very important.
Because you know there are two kinds of people in the world.
Those with backups and those without.
Those who have lost data and those who are going to lose data. Yeah,
exactly. So objectmatrix.com. So definitely check that out if that's a solution that you're looking for.
So let's talk about how you, when I think everybody here has done some kind of brand integration, host sponsorship, whatever it is type of deal. I mean, that's exactly what you're talking about, Tim, that you did with MDialog. I know, Clay, that, you know, you've done that with Baby Bjorn. Tim Shea, you've done that for many of your shows. Now, I was having a conversation this morning with David Price, who is the host of The Middle Show, and that's a show on Black 20, which I like a lot. It's kind of like a sketchy
it's
sort
a great
of
show.
Yeah, it's he's really funny, so talented. And they had an advertiser this summer, Looped, LOOPT, mobile phone location, everybody knows where you are at all time service, like something I would never use personally. But I was talking about this. You know, in some episodes it felt a little too much. Mm-hmm. In other episodes it was done with just the right touch. And that, of course, is, I think, one of the most critical questions because we don't have that separation of church and state where, okay, here is the Grey's Anatomy scene and here is our sponsor.
Well, but
how do you do it in a way where you don't tick people off?
Yeah, so we have so at Nixon Networks, we just basically, it's like a mantra. We say credible, authentic, transparent. You know, and, you know, those are things you got to keep in mind when you're, you know, and we have a bunch of people in the company. So, of course, there's people now that work on the advertising side and there's people that are producing and, you know, they each get involved in each other's business a little bit there for those reasons that we are trying to find ways to bring the sponsorship into the programming. But they all have to kind of agree on those terms when they're not just talking to each other about how to bring it in, but it's often the way that we talk to advertisers from day one and sponsors when we're talking about them coming in. Our currency is our credibility in this space, and we can't sacrifice it. And you do make mistakes. You do sometimes step too far over the line because we're all experimenting. But the great thing about our medium is that the audience tells you right away. You know,
have you gotten any feedback
on
ads? What will they say? That was too much? Or?
They'll just say, I hated it, or, you know, was that an ad? You know, that's the one thing that, you know, my main goal is to never see a comment that says, was that an ad? You know, we can do it in creative ways, but I definitely want people to know that it was an ad, you know that there was a sponsor involved. You know,
that's good. That's the transparent part of it.
Yeah, that's the transparency.
Right?
And so, So, and you know, I think this is something where television's a good example of what's happening right now. They're all worried about skipping commercials, so they're bringing sponsors in. And I get so angry when, you know, they're not transparent with me. I remember... you know, NBC is doing a lot of it, obviously. And, you know, there was a whole storyline on Heroes where suddenly Claire, there was a whole subplot about Claire getting a free car from her dad. And it was clear that, you know,
Nissan,
and you're like, wait, was that an ad? And then the very first commercial in the pod is, it was a Nissan ad. And, you know, The Office is doing it with, like, you know, there was a whole storyline that revolved around Staples. And you're like, well, are they at Staples because that's a part of the everyday office place? Or is it, and then boom, there's a Staples ad.
And it's harder with scripted content.
It's really hard with scripted content.
Because you can't come out of character and say, well, hey, I'm Jim in the office. And this is actually a nod to our sponsor.
I was just watching Iron Man last night, and he's like, and I have to get a burger first. I have to go get a burger.
Oh, yeah.
And there was no reason. Yeah. There's no reason for him to have a burger. And he's walking up there with a Burger King, you know, little.
Well, there's a very good reason. The movie cost $300 million.
Right. And that, and that saved him, too.
And they paid for it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Now, if he'd fought the Burger King, I think we all would have loved it, you know, and that would have been a great scene.
Or fought.
For part two. We'll see. Clay, so when you've done your sponsorships and your integrations with Baby Bjorn, how have you managed that so that it's clear it's an ad, but so that we hope it wasn't annoying to viewers?
Well, the key for us is planning themes and ideas that will build around the company's messaging and their products that makes for a real easy integration that just feels completely authentic and normal. So that, you know, so we'll do a show on why feeding babies is totally disgusting. Which it is. And in this episode, you know, I had all the guys in the studio like pelting me with different kinds of baby food while I was trying to deliver my lines. It was pretty funny.
See, maybe you just need to have a firmer line with your kids.
Yes. Maybe that's
let's
the key.
Have a conversation about whose parenting style is better. No,
yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, but no, so you know, they've got baby feeding products and it's very easy to integrate that into the show that, in a way that feels totally authentic. So
give the example. How did you do that?
Well, so they say, okay, we've got a new, you know, we want to get our bibs. We want to get our feeding product. Actually, this is a different sponsor. The sponsor for that week was a manufacturer named Boone. Okay. And so Boone makes these really cool high chairs that have like these pneumatic lifts, and they've got you know, they've got these cool spoons and different feeding. So we talked about the different stages in feeding, when they start to go to cereal and when they go to, you know, they start to use the utensils themselves, and when they start to hurl food at you, how to respond. And all during these demos, we
hurl back at them.
Yeah, you know. Sorry, some people do that. I'm not afraid. And so all along the way, as we're talking about these real parenting issues, we're using the sponsors' stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think what we do is we immediately start working with a sponsor to craft shows that are going to both offer value in terms of the information that's there while offering perfect opportunities to, to incorporate their products into that video.
And, okay.
And
that
makes it really the fine line for all of us is really, what's the difference between a sponsorship and an endorsement? You know, when the hosts have so much credibility with their audience, right. You know, the fact is, especially as we get more successful, you know, it's great now because we're often going out and seeking sponsors. So that sort of self-selects. A lot of times we go to sponsors that we know our audience will like. We know we like the product. But then, you know, what sort of precedent are you setting? Do you have to endorse every product that you talk about on your show?
And I've turned down products.
Yeah, we have to.
Yeah.
Like, if we don't, I mean, we've had plenty. I mean, actually, it drives PodTrack is very, they're very patient with me. Because they'll be like, I'm like, nope, I don't want to do that one, you know, and because I don't use, and everyone that's advertised, whether it's Object Matrix or Audible or Drobo or all these other companies, these are all things we were using before they were advertising,
right?
You know, and
so,
if they're not,
yeah, but part of like building this, you know, we think a lot about, you know, we're trying to think about scalability and how you build a big business, and it's that exact. You know, it's that exact limitation that keeps us from being able to bring more advertisers in. And so one of the things we think a lot about is, you know, sort of how do you also bring sponsors in ways where you don't have to endorse the product, you know, where, because there's other ways that a sponsor, you know, the fact is, you know, we've got a great relationship with Starburst. They're sponsoring one of our big shows. I don't know if everybody in the audience is, you know, I wouldn't have picked Starburst necessarily as the perfect sponsor, you know, in that, you know, that's not how we sought it out. But what we said is, this is a company that's supporting great content, and Starburst's whole, you know, their whole you know, their whole campaign was about, you know, supporting like new ways of sharing and new ways of voices. And that's something that, you know, and so we actually played off of that a lot. And we actually ended up building a storyline into our show where the hosts are actually ambivalent about having a sponsor. And what does it mean for them? And how does it compromise them creatively to have a sponsor involved? And the, you know, the fun thing right now about this space is that, you know, sponsors are getting in and letting you play and letting you do those sorts of things. And so what we're all trying to figure out now, I guess, is sort of, and I think one of the great ways to do it is if a sponsor can provide something to the community that adds more value to the community, then it becomes more about, you know, the sponsor doing something great in the space.
So I mean, when they decorated the clothes with the Starburst, did it get stuck in the sewing machines?
That was a different network. But actually, ironically, you know, that same, you know, right around the same time that we kicked off the Starburst sponsorship on Channel Frederator and Night Fight, we did actually get somebody who sent in somebody who made their prom, you know, because Threadbanger's all about recycling. Somebody made their whole prom outfit, their tuxedo and dress out of like old Starburst wrappers.
Nice.
And I thought that was incredible. We never really crossed the two over.
I want to see that. So, send me a picture of that. Tim, yeah, Tim Street, you were talking about turning down sponsors. How do you make that decision? Well, is it a gut reaction? Like, nah, I would never use this? Or?
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. And then there's also, because of French made TV is PG-13, and French maids have this dark, you know, aspect to it that, you know, had I gone with Hula Girls, I would be much more family friendly with less clothing. But for whatever reason, we get these questionable sponsors for adult products.
Oh, so racist. Okay.
And I'm not going
there.
You know, I mean, with French made TV, it's PG-13 content. We don't cross that line. There's no nudity. It's all innuendo. It's very Benny Hill. It's very Austin Powers.
Do you have to deal with that perception? Do you feel that there are people out there? I mean, we know what your show is all about, but other folks out there think, oh, Tim, he does pornographic stuff or softcore porn, which is not. Like, watch the show. They're just sexy.
Yeah. It's just silly fun. I mean, we never cross a line, but a lot of people, when they first hear the name, that's immediately what they think.
Mm-hmm.
And you
shame
know,
on
I,
them.
I have to say that probably helps the view count.
Exactly.
No.
Right.
Come on.
And the ample
happy
bosoms.
I have to say, I was just in France, and
on the internet,
your French maids are way better looking than the French maids that were.
You were just at the wrong
hotel.
They're
mostly large and very angry with us most of the time.
protesting, I'm sure.
One of the things I wanted to talk about is when should you do a distribution/partnership deal and when not? You know, we have a lot of listeners who are web video producers or podcast producers, and you know, some of them even, you know, John Flowers recently did the deal to become part of Susan Brennan's podcast network. So I think this is an issue that comes up for a lot of independent content creators. And we have a great mix here today because Clay's show is distributed by For Your Imagination, which is a web studio and distribution shop. Tim Shea is with Next New Networks, which is a larger company that does that and distributes videos out and believes in this kind of super syndication. Then Tim Street, of course, is a lone wolf. Warrior. Clay, let's start with you. How did you make the decision to partner with For Your Imagination, and what are the benefits and what are the drawbacks?
Well, we've got a great relationship with For Your Imagination. You know, kind of the way the whole industry is evolving, our relationship with them is evolving as well. I think when you're just starting out, it's so hard not to be tempted as you're trying to get up over the horizon where you have enough views, you know, to be able to really go to an advertiser and lure them in. You're sort of looking for some help, somebody to get you up over that horizon. And the thing that really worked with the kind of FYI model is they kind of helped get us set up. You know, they helped us create our web presence. They introduced us to a lot of editors at different video sharing sites that, you know, resulted in higher profile and some initial views. It helped us, you know, establish ourselves as, it's also as an independent producer, it helped us because it's like an imprimatur of this organization that says, this is a good show. You know, this is good enough to be in our stable. And all those things are really really, really helpful to us. And, you know, now our relationship with them is kind of evolving as, you know, as we're able to manage some of these things. So a lot of the responsibilities of distribution and, you know, production and web management are sort of rolling back to us while we keep our relationship with them on the sales and PR side.
So may I ask, do you adjust the revenue sharing as you take on more of the management side?
We do in that we don't have an exclusive sales relationship with FYI. So FYI can represent us and goes out and does a great job working with those bigger accounts, working with agencies. You know, they can sort of penetrate the New York market in a way that we really can't, being in humble old Austin, Texas. But what we do is we've got a lot of contact with those kind of mid-sized companies, and that's where a lot of our advertising comes from. So we kind of divide and conquer. They go after the big boys, we go after the baby Bjorns of this world, and together we manage to get most of that inventory sold. So, you know,
and of course, you have to stay. I'm presuming you need to stay in contact. Hey, I'm talking to this person. Okay, great. I'll hit up this person or whatever. Because that doesn't always happen, even within the same organization.
We have to. Communication is really important, particularly being, you know, at some remove. We've got to be on the phone. And say, okay, I'm pitching. You know, I'm pitching 2 weeks to this brand. You know, Playtex got in touch with us. Speaking of bad advertisers, we did once get approached by a paternity testing company, which I thought would be sort of an awkward fit with us.
If you want to be talking about a dad, but you're not sure.
How did you, I would like to know what
That'd
you said.
That'd be a great segment, though. You know, a great segment of how to find out if you're really dad.
It was almost instantly, the guy from the company and I were laughing about it. You know, I was like, you know, dude, I'm just not sure.
That could be a great relationship, though, because when you get a positive test, you know, they just, you know, tell you to start watching the show, you know, start getting ready.
A week on what to do when your kid doesn't look like you.
I think that You Suck at Photoshop has handled that topic pretty well. Now, Tim Street, talk about have you had opportunities and overtures from distribution partners like a Next New or an FYI or somebody else, and how do you make your decision to go it alone?
Well, you know, going it alone isn't always that fun. I mean, it's a lot of fun making the shows. Doing ad sales is not something that I grew up doing. So I had to study. I had to go pick up some books. I had to learn about
ad sales for dummies or something.
I think I found one called Clients and Lovers, and it talks about how finding a client is the same as finding a lover. You make contact, you create interest, you create a preference, you ask for the sale, you close the sale, and you keep the sale closed. And that just, you know, made sense to me. And it's been very useful. The other thing is dealing with CRM, you know, the customer relationship management software and you know, tracking your leads. And it's just, it's not fun stuff. I mean, as a creative person, I just want to go create, post it, and get paid.
So why don't you partner then with somebody that could handle more of that stuff?
You know, my model's so different, and the rates that I charge are so much more than what other people are getting that, you know, I haven't found a fit.
Okay. Fair enough. All right, Tim. Shay, so as you're talking to, you find shows that you like. What is that push-pull between you as the distributor and the content creators? What do they want? What are you able to give them? What do you not want to give away?
Right. Well, you know, what Tim Street was talking about is a good segue, because, you know, we started out as a bunch of guys like Tim. You know, it was, you know, we were all doing it ourselves. We actually, you know, I met Tim was one of the first people I met those days because, you know, one of my partners had a podcast called VOD Cars. Another one of my partners had one called Channel Frederator, doing about the same kind of numbers as French Made. You know, there were a couple people out there that were sort of those early, you know, top 10 podcasts. And I think everybody in those days, Tim can probably back me, you know, 2 years ago or whenever this was.
Back in 05.
Back in all those days. Yeah. Everybody I knew that had a really popular podcast that was getting a million downloads or something, you know, and was being featured was like, we should have 10 of these. We should have a company that has 10 of these. And it was an idea that a lot of us were all talking a lot about, because we saw a lot of those things that we didn't want to do. Is, you know, I was a producer, I was a creator, and you know, and it was so frustrating to do ad sales or do, you know, the distribution. And there wasn't a lot of it that was that specific to the show. I mean, when you get down to talking about the creative and the proposal, sure, you got to know the show, but all those things that Tim's talking about are things that if you can share them across a couple different shows, you gain some, you know, you gain some efficiency there. And so when we first started the company, we were just like, well, we've got a couple of these that are great. I was also working with Rockaboom and Afterworld and a couple other popular shows. And we're like, you know, what if you just had 100 of these in one place? You know, you could, everything that's a shared resource, you can put under one roof, and then the people who are the producers can concentrate just on the two things that are most important, which is making a great show and interacting with your audience. You know, and you know, getting closer to them, and they shouldn't, you know, they should be able to offload as much of the other stuff, the distribution, the ad sales, the platform, to a shared team. And so, so we're a little different, I think, than some companies in that we're not really a distributor. You know, we usually have, you know, a pretty significant ownership stake in any of the content that we're putting out. I mean, it's as a couple of content creators who started a media company, you know, that's what we cared about. We were working on projects that other people owned, and we wanted to you know, work on our own. So that's part of the you know, when we talk to somebody that's got a great show and needs our help, our model for the last 2 years hasn't been something that can fit everybody out there. And usually my first conversation with most people that are already out there and putting their stuff out and having some success is, more likely than not, I say, you can do all this yourself, you know, and our policy is usually just tell them everything we know, you know, and I've talked very openly with Tim, with Clay, with a lot of other people in the space, and just like, well, this is what we're doing. We're always an open book. If you ever want to know how we did this or how we cut this deal or how we did that, you know, because I think we're all right now just, I can't help most people that because we're not a good fit for them. You know, we're the people that have come
when
over
when are you a good fit then? What's an example?
So I think we're a really good fit for people who want to be part of something. You know, we're trying to build a company, and every one of us that's in Next Thing Networks has a stake in that company. So people who want to, you know, I think Eric Beck said it really well to me once. Eric Beck was an independent producer who started out making a show with us called Backyard Effects, and now he's a full employee of Next Thing Networks and a producer there and produces Indie Mogul, our filmmaking network. And, you know, I once asked Eric, you know, I was like, why did you just drop everything, move from San Francisco and come work at Next New? You know, and he said, I just wanted to be with people who are like me. And I think, you know, that's sort of what we've been pulling together is, you know, we've been pulling together a company of people that want to be part of this thing that we're building. And it's just now that we've gotten pretty good at, you know, we're realizing the limitations of what we did the first year or two, which is, you know, producing a lot of it on our own or having a pretty significant creative stake in everything we do. We're realizing that to get much bigger than we are right now, it's going to be harder. You know, we don't want to just keep producing. You know, we don't want to be a studio. We don't want to be a production shop. We want to be a company that and we're much more interested in being a programming company, a company that you know, the most important thing for us is about building audiences, and that doesn't necessarily mean that we have to be the best people at making shows or the best people at advertising. We can partner in lots of different ways if what we're focused on is building networks that have an audience and building relationships with advertisers. So right now we're actually starting to think a lot more creatively about how do we partner with independent people? You know, we've done a couple of things. Epic Foo, we worked with for a year. We work with Zaproot, which is an independent show. And we've done a year's worth of work with TPM TV and Josh Marshall and his great company, Talking Points Memo. Those have all been different models that we've tried out. And
where just, you don't own the show.
Where we don't
then.
Necessarily
right.
have, you know, ownership. And, you know, an interesting thing that we just launched today is a network that we did in partnership with a new company called Non-Society. And so we've launched a style network together. Where
so you've got Julia Allison.
Yeah with you know, Julia Allison, Megan Asha, and Mary Rambin, three popular bloggers in New York. And you know, they came to us with the basic idea for a show. We collaborated together and created it as, you know, and built it into a full network. And it's an interesting new model for us. We don't know where exactly it's going, but we're excited about it.
Who owns it?
We both have an ownership stake in the show, which is a really new model for us. And then we're also now doing some other things that are pretty interesting, where we're working with people who have full ownership of their show, but they can sort of plug into the network that we've built in terms of advertising and distribution. So we're going to do a little bit of.
So that's something that you would do.
We're
as
trying
well.
A lot okay. of different models out now that you know now that we're in the mode where we want more inventory, and that allows you to be more creative with the kinds of partnerships you can have with people, as opposed to when you're just spending money, which is sort of a lot like, you know, what us VC backed companies were doing the first year or two. But now that we're actually making money, now it's more about what's the right model for this business? And the answer is probably a mix. You know, if you really want to be a media company, you want to have some things that you own. you want to have a stake in the things that you do, and you want to have smart deals with the independents that you work with, and hopefully it's all based on what does the audience need and what do the advertisers need. That, and those are the things that really drive our business. And the deals are secondary. You know, we want, you know, there's already a lot of big media companies out there that care more about their content, their copyrights than their audience. The only way that we're all going to succeed is if we're sort of flipped the other way around.
So, Alex.
Well, we do a little bit of everything. So we have our own little network, you know, pixelcore.tv, which is what the show's on. And so we have our own little group of the shows that we like, or the shows that we make. But then we've done everything from that to we're on other people's shows. We produce other people's shows. Sometimes we're just literally, there have been some networks that we've worked for that we show up in their shirts and shoot their shows and then build the whole thing and hand it back to them, and no one knows that we ever worked on their shows, you know? And so, but so it's everything from that all the way to owning our own piece and then doing some stuff where we do a package of shows for networks, a variety of online networks, or, you know, and so for us, you know, we play with all of it. For us, there's kind of, I was talking to a network executive for an online network about like what we expect, you know, and as we go into it, you know, there's, you know, control versus cash. You know, it's a lot of how I look at it. There's a sliding scale of,
absolutely.
You know, and for me, you know, and some of it also has to do with, you know, do I need money for it up front or do I need it down the path? If I have a lot of, faith in the network that I'm working with, that they're going to be able to go out and find advertising, that they have a track record, that they have people on the hook, that they understand the model that we're talking about, you know, I might be willing to do it for a lot less, you know, knowing that I'm getting 70% or 50%. Like if I'm doing it for free, I pretty much am going to expect about 70% of the revenue that comes in for advertising. You know what I mean? If I'm just giving it to you and letting you run with it, or if you're representing it or whatever, but if you're paying me X amount per show. So let's say it's a 5-minute show and you're paying me $5,000 or $10,000 or whatever per episode. You can do whatever you want with it. It's not my problem anymore. You know what I'm saying? And we'll do, and we always are trying to do the best job we can. We don't really, you know, to us, every show we're trying to figure out how to knock it out. And then there's a sliding scale in between where if you're paying me $500 or $1,000, well, we can offset that, you know, as far as, or $2,000. Well, I can, the more you pay, the less I expect in the back end.
It's got to be a win-win deal.
Yeah. And you got to figure out what, and so we're getting more flexible. The problem we have right now, frankly, is that we're just so busy that we can't do too much stuff on spec, or not spec, but lower prices than what really makes sense.
Yeah, you got to pick your investments.
And so, you know, I'm finding that too as a reporter, that there are certain areas, but should I be doing this job or this job, or can I take on this one? But I think that's actually, I think we should all look at that as a good sign that we're starting to experience it, because that means there is money to be made. And that's one thing that my editor at TV Week, Greg, has always been, you know, hammering for my stories. He's like, is anybody making money yet in web video? Is anybody making money in new media? And the fact that a lot of us are saying we're getting busier, so we have to kind of take away some of the things that aren't as financially.
Well, and we definitely invest in areas, you know, like for instance, right. You know, I'm in almost everything that we do, we're personally interested in. So there's not, we don't look at a market and try to figure out how we're going to fit into this market. You know, we love, you know, and I'm sure that most of us working on the shows that we're working on, whether it's parenting or you know, all the stuff that you guys are doing or what Tim's doing. I mean, I know Tim likes French maids a lot. You know, it's a passion of his. You know, I went to his, you know, I can imagine Tim having little models of French maids. Anyway, so the, for us, you know, like Potential Energy is a new show that we put out, which is just all about renewable energies. Now, why we don't have any sponsor for it. You know, you will. Oh, we will. No. And we've got, and Kirsten Sanford, who does This Week in Science and Food Science and everything else. So the two of us just want to do the show. You know, we just love talking about, we found ourselves talking all the time about these green energies and everything else. And we started with audio, and we're going to move to video.
And we shouldn't forget that this industry grew out of hobbies. Right. You know, I mean, we're all sitting around this room, you know, making an audio podcast. It was the people that did it for the passion that did this first, including you, I'm sure. And right. You know, I mean, we were inspired, Next Thing Networks was inspired by this confluence of video blogging, YouTubers, you know, and podcasting. And those are all hobbyist-built things, you know, but they all showed that there's an alternative distribution system here. There's no barrier to entry to making a show or making a channel. And you know, I think that's what's exciting about this whole thing, right, is that we all have choices and we can decide. Cool. And the longer that you can do it on your own, I mean, we've all shown this is a hard business to be in. The more that you can do yourself, just the more leverage and the more negotiating power you're going to have when it does, you know, get to that point of making, if you do want to turn into a business or take that next step, you know, the more independent that you are, the better you'll be. And
I think the other thing, though, that I find is working with other people, no matter how stressful it can be, oftentimes makes the show better. So absolutely. I think This Week in Photography is another show that we do that is much better because Scott Bourne is involved, you know, because he's very much of, this has to be done by 9 o'clock on Monday night, and this has to be this way, and it has to be this way, and these things have to be, you know, he's very like,
he knows his stuff too.
What?
He knows his stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a great show because we have a bunch of radio guys that love photography. So, yeah, you know, we understand the rules of radio, but we also have Aaron who does all the producing. So he's the one that makes us actually sound like we know what we're talking about most of the time. And but we have all these people, and that interaction between us, the one thing that I think that some people make mistakes on when they get into this is doing it by themselves. You know, and it's that there's a lot of tension oftentimes over the show between Scott and I, but it's a better show because I'm very particular about certain things and he's very particular about, I'm really particular from the art point of view, and he's very particular from the business point of view, and we both love photography and we both love radio, good radio, and we love, you know, and so it turns out to be a good show. It doesn't, but it would be easier to do it on my own. I just don't think it would be nearly as good.
Well, Clay, you've got a couple different co-hosts for your show. Do you ever butt heads, and how do you deal with it?
We absolutely butt heads. You know, our origin story is sort of that all three of the founding guys, we're all teachers at the same high school in Austin, Texas. And one of my co-founders and I had written a book. We were teaching film. And we had written a book about making your first film for teenagers, and it was called Pulling Off Your Shorts. And the book was fairly successful, and suddenly we were talking to kids at conferences all over the place about making films, and we'd never made one. We are teachers, you know, and so the company grows out of an effort of me and my two buddies. We would meet down at the maintenance department of the school at night after we'd put the kids to bed. It was a boarding school. We all lived on the campus. So we put the kids to bed. We'd go down and we'd take a little adult refreshment. We would go down to the maintenance shed and we would try to cook up our brilliant movie that we were going to make. And what ended up happening was we'd have these bull sessions about our sleep deprivation, irritated, breastfeeding stories or what. And we were like, well, that's
breastfeeding
it.
Breastfeeding was getting you down.
Yeah. No, I was rubbing that lanolin in day and night. Anyway, so it became somehow, you know, our subject matter came to us fairly organically, that this is what we're going to do. This is what our story is.
Did you say, let's do this as a web series?
No, because that was a while back, and we decided what we're going to do is DVDs. And so we made a DVD like nights, weekends, summer vacations, we're barring people's homes, and we made this video on how to be a guy, you know, and how to survive pregnancy. And we actually did a traditional Hollywood, you know, we made this DVD, we got a Hollywood distribution deal, we're all excited, and they didn't do squat. And so we were really frustrated, so I say, oh, we're going to do another DVD. We did one on labor and delivery. They're for sale. They're on Amazon. Doodads. We decided, okay, we'll distribute the second one on our own. And of course, that self-distribution effort led us to the web, led us to realizing the power of web video, and our company changed. And we said, we're not going to do any more DVDs. We're going to do a web show.
And when did Dad Loves actually launch?
Well, we started experimenting with putting videos on the web 2 years ago. Almost exactly a year ago is when we really launched in our current form. We're doing 4 shows a week. That's when we relaunched with the help of FYI, and that's when we all quit our jobs.
I love your backstory. That's a great backstory.
That's awesome.
I mean, I think, you know, the listeners should really pay attention to that because that's how it starts. That's how these things come together in this business, because I think there's still a perception that it's easy. You just, let me get out my MacBook and turn on the webcam and boom. And, you know, we've talked about this before on the show. It's not so much about doing video blogs anymore, but you're talking about, you know, a group of people that have, you know, real skills and they have film expertise and, you know, they take time to put it together. And, you know, you make the investment. You're doing this on your weekends, which is, you know, it's hard to get away from the family because you're all dads. And that's the whole point. But you do this and you really have to build something before you can start to see the reward. You can't, for those who are successful at gaining an advertiser in your second week, I salute you. I mean, it took me a year to get one for my show. So, but I just think that your story is evidence that there's a lot of heavy lifting involved. And that's why when you said, this industry's grown out of hobbies, you really have to care about what you're doing. It has to be something you're passionate about, or you're not going to want to make that investment. So on that note, Clay, where can people find you?
You can find us at www.dadlabs.com.
And Mr. Tim Street?
You can read my blog at onetimstreet.com, and be sure to check out frenchmadetv.com and subscribe at iTunes.
There you go. Tim Shea, best place to find you?
NextNewNetworks.com, and you can... it's not the greatest website in the world because we're not trying to compete with YouTube there, but you can definitely at least see all the networks from there, and there's a lot more once you dive in. We've got a couple of key ones to check out, are probably Barely Political, Threadbanger, Indie Mogul, if you love cars, Fastlane Daily, the list goes on. So just there's probably something for everybody there.
Alex Lindsay.
You can find me on the Twitters.
Alex Lindsay.
Also, just a real quick note that for the geeky side of our listeners, we are doing a moto modeling intensive with Dan Ablin, who's probably one of the top moto trainers in the world, in a couple weeks. They can find out more at pixelcore.com.
And you can find me on Twitter at Daisy Whitney, at my website, daisywhitney.com. And please go to tvweek.com and click on lots of pages and support my main
mostly play the video.
Visit several times a day. Set up, little auto plays, whatever you have to do. Just drive a ton of traffic and make my editors happy. We are over and out.